Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, July 17, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear about the reauthorization of Section 2702. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Adam Klein, Senior Fellow at the Center for New American Security, and Kate Martin, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and our moderator, Karen Lugo, who's the founder at the Libertas West Project. I will turn it over to Karen to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Karen. The floor is yours.
First, I would like to thank both of our expert speakers today and remind you that if you'd like to look at their full bios, those are available with the email announcement on this teleforum as it went out. I did want to make a special note, though, to say that both of them are highly involved in all three aspects of this debate on the FISA Act reauthorization of Section 702, and that includes the arenas of public policy, which would be the citizen interest, as well as congressional testimony and inquiries. And then finally, they also are very involved in writing and developing these issues on an ongoing basis. So we are going to first ask Adam Klein if he will kind of just give us an overview of Section 702 and how it works, what the program entails, and what is up for authorization, reauthorization this year. And those debates have already started in Congress. And then we will ask Kate Martin to give her perspective on the program, and then back to Adam Klein for his kind of editorial comments on the program. So, Adam, over to you.
Sure. Thanks, Karen, and thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting and to Kate as well for joining us and participating today. I thought it would just be helpful to give our listeners a very concrete sense of what the government is doing under this program, why it's doing it, and where it fits into the broader architecture of electronic surveillance for foreign intelligence purposes. So basically, the legal authority for foreign intelligence surveillance depends on two factors. They're basically geographic factors, the location of the collection and the citizenship of the person who's being targeted. So let's talk about non-U.S. persons, non-Americans, since that's the primary focus of Section, since that's the exclusive focus of Section 702 under the law. If a non-citizen, let's say a Russian diplomat, for example, is in the United States and the government wants to collect his phone calls, then they have to go before the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, and get a probable cause warrant from a judge. So that's the traditional Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978 for foreigners in the United States. Now, if the government wants to conduct intelligence activities overseas, targeting someone overseas, then there's no judicial involvement whatsoever, and it's not regulated by statute. Executive Order 12333 regulates that, and it's within the president's constitutional authority to conduct foreign affairs. What we're talking about today, Section 702, is a middle ground between those two authorities. It's when the collection takes place here in the United States, but the non-American who's being targeted is overseas. And that's something that happens with much greater frequency in the digital age. The reason why is that the internet is not structured to respect geographic boundaries. So someone who's using an email account from Yemen, those emails could be stored in the United States, or they could transit the United States on internet backbone cables, either on the way to a destination in the U.S. or to somewhere else in the world. And so it's that disjunction between the location of the user and the location of the communications that makes Section 702 so valuable. And so the very bare bones of how the law works, just to give a quick explanation, the government is allowed to target non-Americans overseas when their communications pass through the United States. And importantly, it does not have to get an individualized judicial order to do that. The FISA court, the secret court set up by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, reviews this program, but it only reviews it as a whole once a year. And so that means that it takes a lot less work for the government to, say, collect the emails of a terrorist in Yemen than it does to monitor the phone calls of, for example, a Russian diplomat here in the United States. And that makes sense from a constitutional perspective, because as we know, the Fourth Amendment does not apply to non-Americans overseas. Just one final note on the technical aspect of how this program is implemented. We actually have a lot of information about this from the 2014 report put out by the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which gave unprecedented detail about how this program works. There are two basic ways that the government can get these electronic communications under Section 702. When data is stored here in the U.S., so let's say there's a user, jihadijohn@mail.net, who we know to be a non-American terrorist overseas, say in Syria, the government can go to mail.net, assuming it's a U.S. company, and get everything it has on its servers for that account. That's what we call the program's downstream component, sometimes referred to as PRISM. The government can also filter out from internet traffic as it moves across cables here in the United States messages to or from that address, jihadijohn@mail.net. It can't do the same for keywords, so terrorism or assassinate the president, and it can't use names. It has to use a specific selector. So that's an email address or a phone number or something along those lines. So that's a very brief rundown of how the program works. And Karen, I believe you'll now turn it over to Kate to talk about some of the privacy implications from our perspective.
Yes. So good afternoon. This is Kate Martin, and thank you both to Karen and to Adam and to the Federalist Society for inviting me to participate. I thought I would just outline a couple of issues. This is actually, Adam's done a great job of outlining the law, but it's complicated. The Section 702 is part of the FISA Amendments Act, which was first passed in 2008. As a result of the revelation that the Bush administration had been engaged in a warrantless surveillance program inside the United States. Section 702 is due to expire in December unless the Congress reauthorizes it and extends it. And what the Congress is at the moment doing is considering what, if any, reforms should be made to the law as it currently stands if they decide to reauthorize it. So I want to just talk about a couple of those and highlight some of the concerns that we in the civil liberties and privacy and human rights community have about the law, and start with distinguishing a situation where we would not have the same kinds of concerns that we do about 702. And that's the situation where a foreigner located overseas is communicating with another foreigner located overseas, but because of the way the internet is configured, those communications travel through facilities located in the United States, where the United States government would be capable of seizing those foreign-to-foreign communications. That, I think, as Adam and I would both agree, would not raise the same kind of Fourth Amendment problems that we are concerned about under 702, because, as Adam pointed out, foreigners overseas don't have any Fourth Amendment rights. And that's it. And one could say that despite the fact that the seizure is taking place in the United States, that's an kind of accidental feature. But in fact, what 702 does is that it authorizes the government to intentionally seize communications between foreigners located overseas and people located in the United States who are communicating with each other, even when the government has reason to know or knows that the person being communicated with is inside the United States. That seizure is accomplished in the United States and, in our view, is protected by the Fourth Amendment. Nevertheless, this law does not require that the basic incidence of the Fourth Amendment be applied to that kind of seizure, that being a determination of probable cause, a determination by an independent judicial magistrate, or a search warrant that's specific and particularized. And remarkably enough, that feature of the law, which allows the government to target foreigners overseas and deliberately seize their communications with people located in the United States, is not being challenged overall in the current debate. There is one of the objections is that the purpose for which those seizures are now allowed, which is foreign intelligence, is too broad and it should be narrowed. But there are two other objections to the 702 as it's currently constituted and proposals for reform. One has to do with the number and scope of foreigners who may be targeted under 702. As I mentioned, anyone can be targeted if the purpose of the targeting, who's a foreigner overseas, if the purpose of the target is foreign intelligence. That obviously includes a whole range of subjects. The range of foreign intelligence interests that the United States government looks at has expanded greatly in the last few decades, as has its capacity to both seize and keep and analyze information. So you have the result that 702 authorizes the collection of literally millions, if not billions, of communications on individuals overseas. And there is, I think, growing concern among U.S. allies that 702 is being used to target innocent Germans, French, British, etc. The last concern that I want to raise just in this initial is what happens to the information after it's been seized by the government, all without any kind of warrant. At the moment, the NSA and the FBI and the CIA all are permitted to keep the electronic communications, including the communications between people inside the United States, including known citizens and foreigners who have, which communications have been obtained under 702. We know as a result of the PCLOB's investigation that Adam referred to, that whenever the FBI does any kind of preliminary check on an individual in the U.S., including a citizen, it checks its databases, which include the communications that have been seized under 702. If it finds a communication by the individual who it's checking on, it not only notes the existence of that communication, but it can read or listen to that communication. So in effect, you have a tool where the NSA is collecting vast amounts of international communications by Americans and others within the United States, storing them, and then the FBI, in the course of any kind of preliminary investigation, can search for an individual American without a warrant, again, without any probable cause, et cetera. And if that search generates a communication, they not only note the existence of that communication, but they read it, having never obtained a warrant that covers that communication. So I'm sure Adam and I can talk more about the rights and wrongs of that. One of the key reforms being proposed by the advocacy community is that the FBI should be required, before it uses the identity of a U.S. person inside the U.S., to search the database of communications collected under 702. Before it may do that, it should obtain a warrant, either under FISA or under Title III, on the basic theory that Americans' communications should not be read by the government unless it has a warrant. So I think I'll leave it there and wait for Adam's response.
Now to Adam Klein from the Center for a New American Security.
Thanks, Karen. I think an important thing to inject here, which is where I'll start, is the demonstrated, at least in the unclassified record, value of this program and why it's the intelligence community's declared top legislative priority for this year. And there is a fair amount of publicly available evidence, both from the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board report from 2014, and then more recently from public statements from IC officials and also declassified documents. So just to give a few examples, back in 2014, the Privacy Board reported that over 25% of NSA's reports on terrorism included information from 702, and that this percentage had consistently increased every year. There are several specific cases in which the government has achieved important counterterrorism breakthroughs based on 702. The most famous case was in 2008. The government was monitoring the email address of an al-Qaeda courier in Pakistan, and an email arrived at that in that person's inbox from the United States, and that unknown American was requesting advice on making explosives. So obviously that's a red alert moment. The NSA immediately alerted the FBI, which used its ordinary investigative powers to investigate and found the person was named Najibul Azazi, living in Colorado. And he and his friends had imminent plans to blow up the New York subway. And there are a few other examples which I won't delve into here. But more broadly than that, we don't want to over-focus on this metric of how many individual plots did you stop, because we also know that 702 is a vital part of the overall mosaic that our intelligence community has built of how terrorist groups work, how they communicate, how they move money, how they move people, and various other things. So this is a key tool for counterterrorism, among other legitimate signals intelligence purposes. Just also to give a bit of context, we know from the intelligence community's annual transparency report that there were more than 100,000 overseas non-Americans targeted using 702 last year, and that compares to only 1,600 targets of court orders under the traditional provisions of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for people in the United States. So we know that this is getting heavy use, and that is also some indication of how valuable it is. So now I want to move on to the point that Kate made, that the government is, quote unquote, intentionally seizing the communications of known Americans. So what Kate is referring to, and Kate, you can jump in and tell me that I'm misrepresenting what you're saying, if indeed I am, is that when the government targets the email account, for example, of a non-American overseas, say it could be a terrorist in Pakistan, as we were just talking about, that person may sometimes communicate with people in the United States. And if that happens, then that American's half of the conversation, so to speak, will also be collected, right? Just like if I send an email to my friend and my friend's account is then subpoenaed by the FBI, then my messages to that person will go into the hands of the FBI. That's what's known as incidental collection. Now, it's not accidental, right? We're surveilling that target precisely so that we can find out who the target is communicating with. It's incidental because the American is not the target of the surveillance. And just to give a comparison here, if when the Navy SEAL stormed into Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan and took his laptop, and if they had found correspondence from Americans on that laptop, no one would argue that that requires a warrant. Clearly, the search of Osama bin Laden's premises in Afghanistan, it's not in the U.S., he's not an American, it's not covered by the Fourth Amendment. And that's the same argument here, that because the target is not covered by the Fourth Amendment, then the incidental collection of an American who communicates with that target is just part of the nature of the beast, and that doesn't require a separate warrant. Now, obviously, anything that results in the collection of Americans' communications and their storage by the U.S. government creates privacy concerns, and those are real. I don't trivialize them at all, but it's not a Fourth Amendment problem. And every court to consider this has said that Section 702 is constitutional. So Kate also talked about concerns raised by some of our international partners that they're afraid that we're going to be surveilling innocent Germans or innocent French people. So recently, Director Comey said that Section 702, back when he was director, said that Section 02 has only been used for national security threats, not just for general snooping on the opinions of foreign people. And he cited as a couple examples counterterrorism and countering proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Now, the full list of topics for which the government uses 702 is not public. It's still classified, but it is a finite list. And so based on that, we know that there's a finite list of things that are national security threats. It's not just the general gossip of foreign citizens about the United States. But I want to step back a little bit. When we're talking about these foreign partners, I think it's fair to ask, are they doing this too? And are they doing it subject to the same extensive safeguards that the United States has put in place? And the answers to those questions are respectively, yes, they are doing it too. And B, no, they are not doing it subject to the same safeguards. So we know that Germany passed a law recently, to their credit, putting on the public record their government's authority to do the exact same thing as the U.S. government is doing under Section 702. And it specifies certain characteristics, certain categories of people who get special protection under the law. It's EU governments, EU member states, and EU citizens. U.S. citizens get no special protection under German law. Meanwhile, a presidential policy directive that the U.S. put in place in 2014 and that the Trump administration has kept on the books gives all non-U.S. citizens certain rights and protections for their privacy, including the data that's collected under 702. And that hasn't been reciprocated by any European country. France, another country that Kate mentioned, conducts very aggressive intelligence operations. They have a very capable intelligence community. And they are known to, for example, conduct commercial espionage against the United States. And so the question is whether the U.S. should be in the position of apologizing for activities that we conduct that other countries also conduct, but subject to even fewer safeguards. I support the transatlantic relationship very strongly, but it needs to be based on mutual candor rather than one-way accusations. And then the last thing that Kate mentioned, which is the practice of searching databases that have 702 information in them for the identities of known Americans. That's a significant privacy concern. I agree with Kate that far. Even former NSA Director Michael Hayden recently said that in his view, that's not a trivial privacy concern. I do think it's important to note that the courts that have considered it, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is effectively a district court, and then a few other district courts around the country, some of them in dicta, have said that this does not violate the Fourth Amendment. Now, that's obviously not the same thing as a Supreme Court decision or even a Court of Appeals decision, but the existing case law does say that this is not a Fourth Amendment violation. Now, that said, it's still a significant privacy concern, and that's how I think we should talk about it. But I do think it's important to also note the value of this practice. So the 9/11 Commission, when it looked at why the 9/11 attack succeeded, one of the principal causes it pointed to was the intelligence community's failure to connect the dots among different pieces of information that it had in its databases. That's exactly what this practice is designed to ensure happens. If an FBI agent comes across a person of interest in an investigation, the first thing we'd want them to do is check and see whether, for example, we have information already collected and in the Bureau's files indicating that that person is in communication, for example, with someone, an Al-Qaeda member in Yemen. And in fact, if that person were later committed a terrorist attack and the after-action review found that information sitting unexamined on the FBI's database, the public and Congress would be going crazy asking the FBI why it hadn't found that information. And in fact, the commission that looked at Fort Hood attacks and made recommendations for the FBI specifically encouraged the FBI to combine all of its databases to ensure that they were connecting the dots. Now, that said, as I mentioned earlier, I do think that this practice does raise legitimate and serious privacy concerns. In my opinion, the best way to address those concerns at this point is to have more transparency about how the FBI does those queries, and then especially about how the information from 702 gets used in criminal trials against criminal defendants, which is obviously where the constitutional concerns are at their apex. So with that said, I'll turn it back to Karen.
I would like to ask each of you, as you address the points the other has made, to also include thoughts on what the FBI might do to describe what diminished access to the Section 702 databases would mean. So in real terms, what that might mean in cases where they may not have caught. I mean, certainly we've gone back to the example of 9/11, but what other cases, if there were diminished access, might have been a fail in the years since then? And also, and I think this would be Kate Martin, do you think that having an amicus curiae lawyer present when annual certifications are done at the FISA court to make privacy arguments, would that satisfy some of the concerns, or at least be sufficient to console those that are interested in making sure those arguments have at least been heard and debated? And so it would be back to Kate first.
Sure. Thanks for those questions. On the last question, having an amicus present arguments in secret before the secret FISA court has and could be useful, but it's not sufficient. For a lot of reasons, but in fact, the FISA court is the court that has already ruled about this practice of the FBI querying. I don't believe that any court outside of the FISA court, any court that has an open and adversarial process, has yet ruled on that. On your other question about what would the FBI lose? So I think we first have to have kind of a complete understanding of what the FBI has when it has basically unfettered access to the 702 database. 702 allows the targeting of foreigners for foreign intelligence, and those reasons are not confined to national security threats. They include, for example, foreign information that's relevant to the foreign relations of the United States. So the FBI and the NSA have refused to try to even give an estimate of how many communications by Americans are contained in the 702 database. But it does seem like there's probably millions. When we talk about requiring the FBI to get a warrant before it listens to the contents of the 702 communications by Americans, we're not preventing them from accessing or reading those communications when they have a warrant, that is, when they have probable cause, nor are we preventing the FBI from investigating a suspect using the many other kinds of tools which it has before it has probable cause to establish a warrant. One of those tools is that the FBI can run the person's name in its enormous database of lots of different kinds of information. I think Adam mentioned the hypothetical of being worried about an American who may be in communication with a terrorist in Yemen. In that situation, it's very hard for me to think that the FBI doesn't have probable cause to get a warrant to listen to those communications. I think the more worrisome example, and the example that would be prevented by requiring a warrant, is an example that's much closer to something that President Trump has been talking about, which is that he's accused the prior administration of political surveillance of their opponents. The way the law is written at the moment, special agents in FBI offices around the country can pull up the name of an American and basically search the database using the name of that American. They don't need to document a national security reason for doing so. They don't need to document a criminal investigation reason for doing so. They don't even need to document that they've done so. And that's an extremely extraordinary extension of the government's ability to read private correspondence or listen to private communications by Americans. And one of the kind of basic disputes in this whole controversy has to do with, well, you know, if the government has a warrant on me and I talk to Adam, it can listen to Adam's communications with me because it has a warrant on me, but never had a warrant on Adam. And our response to that is, the basic protection of the Fourth Amendment is that when the government seizes communications inside the United States, it has a warrant to do so. And it may not be a warrant on both sides, it's usually not, but it does have a warrant that says there's probable cause to seize those communications, and that's missing in the current 702. Back to you.
Adam Klein, do you have comments?
Sure. Thanks, Karen. So starting with the first element of your question about the amicus advocate before the secret FISA court, I think that's a good idea. I think that it would make the judicial oversight for this program more credible to the public. When I teach law students and when I talk to people who are not in this field and I tell them that there's a secret court that reviews all of this, they're slightly comforted by that. But when they hear that only the government appears before the court, it makes most people a little bit skeptical. And the reason is obvious. We're used to the courts providing a forum for adversarial testing of the arguments that are presented. And so to the extent that you can increase the amount of adversarial testing, especially for a program of this magnitude, that's a good thing. And so I think it would make the judicial oversight more credible, and it would do so without affecting the operational value of the program that I described earlier. The second half of the question, if I recall, was about the FBI's queries of the database that contains some 702 information. I think it's important to note here that the FBI does not get everything or even most of what NSA takes in under this program. The FBI only gets data from the program's downstream component, so that's when the government goes to the internet companies and takes the account information that they're storing on their servers with the compelled assistance of the companies. And it only gets that on certain people that the FBI has nominated based on the investigative information that it has. So they get a small subset of a subset of everything the 702 takes in. So I think that's one important caveat. Then you asked about the effect that imposing a warrant requirement might have on the Bureau. So requiring a warrant before the Bureau can check its databases would, in my opinion and based on my conversations with people with relevant investigative experience, would effectively make these queries useless. The reason is that they're usually doing these routine database checks of what the Bureau already has in its own files at the early stages of an investigation, right? That's when it's most useful. You don't have to do a lot of investigation. You just want to see, is this someone we already know something about that we should be concerned about, right? This is the sort of same type of checks that law enforcement investigations routinely do when they come into it, when they encounter new persons. And getting a court order is so burdensome by contrast, right? You have to make a probable cause showing. You have to have the Justice Department attorneys draft up a thick application. You have to go to the court, that agents would just do it a lot less, even if they could make a probable cause showing. And so the whole point of the Webster Commission, that's the Fort Hood Commission, was to have FBI routinely synthesizing information throughout its files so that we don't miss connections that would indicate a terrorist attack. A final reason is that because you're at the early stages of an investigation, usually when they're doing these database checks, you don't have probable cause. And so the collective effect of this is that you're basically going to be banning these database checks. Now, some people might view that as worth the benefit for privacy, but that's an individual judgment that everyone has to make for him or herself, but we shouldn't delude ourselves. This is going to have consequences for the government's ability to connect the dots, as the 9/11 Commission said, and prevent future attacks.
So could I just raise one question about this? This argument, it seems to me, proves way too much, doesn't it, Adam? Because, of course, it would be most useful if in the early stages of any investigation, the FBI could put a wiretap on whoever it was investigating. We don't allow that. And it's not because, it's burdensome or whatever. It's because the Fourth Amendment already made that determination.
I mean, obviously, go ahead.
And, you know, we're now in a situation where what's available to the FBI in its databases has exponentially expanded from what was available even 20 or 30 years ago. And the FBI's capability of finding what's in its database and using it has also exponentially expanded. And yet, instead of saying, oh, well, the government has much greater surveillance power, and if it listens to an American's communications, it will be able to, within a matter of seconds, link those up to all kinds of other credit card financial data about that American. And that's an awesome power in the hands of the FBI and the government. Therefore, we ought to have greater safeguards. Instead, what we've said is, no, now we're going to permit the government to create a much larger database of Americans' communications and search it when it's never demonstrated probable cause about the particular conversation or the particular American whom it's searching for. It is definitely true that not having, you know, a all-seeing big brother means that you're less efficient. That's definitely true, but it's not a question of privacy. It's really a question of preventing political abuse by the government of these powers. And that, I think, is demonstrated by President Trump's own allegations that the intelligence community's authorities are being used wrongfully to spy on political opponents. I don't think there's any evidence for those allegations, but that's obviously a serious concern in this country.
Adam, before you answer, if I could just inject, a lot of Kate's comments have to do with some of the political questions that are going to come up surrounding the debate for reauthorization. So as you answer, and as we move to Q&A, if there is an appropriate reform, I mean, if a reform is not needed and the program as it exists is defensible and it's an argument that can be made to the American people and Congress, then fine. But if there is an appropriate reform as we move forward and even into Q&A, please suggest any reforms that you think might be proper and helpful.
Sure. So that's a good point and a good fair question. So Kate was saying that, you know, yes, that proves too much, that the fact that it's difficult for the government is no excuse if the Fourth Amendment requires something. You know, I certainly agree that if something is prohibited by the Fourth Amendment, it doesn't matter how useful it is. But remember that we're talking here about a practice that has already been upheld by the most relevant court as consistent with the Fourth Amendment. So then the question is, do the privacy costs outweigh the benefits for national security? So let's look at the evidence. The intelligence community put out an annual statistical transparency report where it said that in only one case had the FBI in one of these queries actually pulled up data on 702. So to the extent that we have any evidence, it shows that the effect of this on American privacy is quite limited at this point. Now, that doesn't
I don't think that's exactly right what it showed. That was one criminal case. It wasn't that the queries only pulled up a conversation once. It was that a criminal
case. In a criminal investigation. And if it's a foreign intelligence investigation, then that's exactly the circumstance in which we want them to be using foreign intelligence information to inform the foreign intelligence investigation. So the evident scale of this practice or of its privacy implications is not as expansive as some might have feared. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't significant hypothetical concerns. I mean, we should worry about that. We should take every measure possible to mitigate those concerns. But the question is, how much counterterrorism capability do we want to give up to do that? And we've seen from the 9/11 Commission report, we've seen from the Fort Hood Commission report, that this data synthesis These type of queries, putting leads together and connecting the dots, is the blue chip way to prevent terrorist attacks. So if we're going to do anything that is going to impose new barriers to connecting the dots, we better think long and hard about it before doing it and make sure that the benefit is worth the cost. Now, I agree with Kate that there are significant concerns associated with this practice. And so, Karen, you asked what we might do about it. There are a few things that we consider. I mean, first, I, as I said, I think we should have always have an amicus advocate before the court when it considers this program, and that would include considering these type of queries and whether they're allowed for the FBI to conduct. I think we should have as much transparency as possible about how many of these queries the FBI conducts, how many of them return information on 702 from the FBI's databases, and then we should also have maximum transparency and even potentially some statutory limitations on when the government can use this information to prosecute people for crimes here in the U.S., because that's obviously the ultimate, the place where the privacy concerns are at their apogee.
Kate, if you want a very, very brief response time, then we'll move to Q&A, and we can address some of these comments as you weave them into answers to questions.
Well, I just want to agree with Adam about the importance of greater transparency, especially about the queries, and maybe raise the question, you know, the government promised transparency about the number of, an estimated number of Americans' communications, and now has said that it won't give us that information before the reauthorization or ever. And so right there we have this kind of problem of, you know, we can say, well, we want greater transparency. They've refused to give greater transparency, so now what do we do?
And on that note, Laura Flint, we are ready to take some questions from the audience.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Looks like we have four questions pending, so let's go to our first.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy, and this is a question for both of the presenters. Over the years, I've tried to assuage my own fears and others' fears about 702 by pointing out that for all the risks and you know, occasionally over-aggressive intelligence gathering, that there seemingly hadn't been any abuses of 702 to go after the government's political enemies. Recently, though, I'm not as confident, you know, after the news about what Susan Rice and other Obama administration officials might have done, and I don't mean to pick on the Obama administration here. I mean, the same sort of things might have happened in previous administrations. And I know I'm not the only one with these newly increased concerns. So my question is, what could be added to 702 to make the alleged Susan Rice type of abuses less likely, or to make the after-the-fact penalty greater, or at least more likely to be imposed? And I guess, you know, a closely related question, how is all this intelligence controversy that we're having this year, the Russians, Susan Rice, leaking, et cetera, likely to affect 702 renewal?
Can I take this one?
Sure.
So this is Adam. I agree with the implied premise of the question, which is that the controversies surrounding alleged political misuse of intelligence have made the climate for Section 702 renewal more challenging. We've seen at least one demonstrated abuse of intelligence information collected from signals intelligence collection, that is the leaks about Michael Flynn's phone calls with the Russian ambassador for political purposes. This is always the great fear of people who follow surveillance issues and are concerned about privacy, that intelligence collected for foreign intelligence purposes is going to be leaked into the political realm to damage Americans who are active in public life. And that happened in this case, and that's a big problem. Now, as far as we know, that was not information from Section 702, But still, the fact that it happened at all is a legitimate subject of concern. You alluded to the Susan Rice controversy. This is the allegation, for those who haven't been following this as closely, that Susan Rice asked to see then the identities of Trump transition and campaign officials whose names had been quote-unquote masked or hidden in intelligence reports to protect their privacy. And those allegations, as far as I know, are being investigated in the classified setting. We don't know, those of us in the public, it's too soon for any of us to say whether those have been substantiated or not. But if true, that this unmasking process was used for political purposes, that would obviously be a big concern. And so we've seen members of Congress who do talk to foreign leaders, who do presumably get, therefore, picked up on some signals intelligence intercepts, express concern about this. And again, that's concern that I understand, because these are people who are active in public life, and they're legitimately fearful that the things that they say in their confidential communications could, if there weren't adequate safeguards in place, be misused to harm them politically. And so people are right to be asking these questions. Now, what I think is important is that these concerns, legitimate as they are, be addressed in an appropriate way. And that means focus on the problem, which, as far as we know, is not 702, but are insufficient controls on leaks and allegedly insufficient controls on unmasking. And so I've proposed some modest changes that I think would be targeted to leaks and unmasking, so enhancing criminal penalties for leaks about Americans that are intended to damage those Americans politically is one thing that we could do. In the unmasking context, we could have post hoc, after the fact, audits of all unmasking requests during transition and campaign periods that relate to people known to be associated with campaigns and transitions. I think those are targeted measures that would alleviate some of these concerns. We don't want to throw the baby with the bathwater, though, and give up valuable collection against foreign spies, foreign cyber threats, terrorists, and other malevolent actors overseas in order to get at these problems, which are more specific than that.
So this is Kate, if I might just disagree a little bit. I do think that the problem of political spying is one of the key problems that needs to be addressed here. And while I agree that 702 hasn't been implicated, there is nothing to prevent 702 from being the source of the information next time. And on the question of how does this controversy affect this debate, I have to say that it was remarkable to me and disappointing to see that the White House, which has been so vocal about its worries about political spying, nevertheless proposed extending 702 in its present form without any reforms whatsoever to address the real potential that it could be used for political spying in the future. On the question of what to do to prevent that kind of abuse of 702 information, I think there's two things. Preventing leaks is a separate problem. The best prevention against misuse of information is for the government to have to go before an independent judge and say, this is the reason we want to see this information, and here's what we're going to do with it, and here's and the government lawyers who make those representations, of course, do so at risk of their career if they mislead the court. And finally, none of the proposed reforms have to do with giving up collection capabilities against foreign terrorists or foreign spies. The backdoor search warrant requirement is simply about when the FBI gets to listen to Americans' communications without a warrant.
So can I just jump in and say one thing here? When Michael Flynn allegedly spoke to the Russian ambassador was on U.S. soil. And what we can infer from that is that to collect his communications, the government had to go before the FISA court and get a warrant based on probable cause to collect his communications. So while I understand that that in our law the warrant requirement has this special sanctity, it's not a panacea, particularly if you're talking about leaks. As Kate said, and I agree with her on this, once the information is in the government's possession, wherever it came from, whether it came from 702, whether it came through a probable cause warrant from the FISA court, leaks are going to be a risk. And so in my view, it would be appropriate if Congress wants to address this to add some sentencing enhancement or some other specific provision to the criminal code to address these type of leaks, like what happened to Michael Flynn.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Devin Williams from the Cato Institute. First, I wanted to ask about the what I just heard. You said that there needed to be a probable cause requirement because he was on the U.S. soil at the time the phone call was made. As far as I'm aware, he was contacting a Russian ambassador, and my guess is we have ongoing surveillance of foreign ambassadors under the 702 program just as a constant basis. I don't know why there would be necessarily a probable cause or warrant requirement for Michael Flynn's communications to the ambassador.
There's actually a separate provision in what's called Title I of FISA, which was the original FISA that required warrants, that is specifically about embassies in the United States. And so it has procedures, which they are not the general warrant procedures for individuals in the United States. They are procedures for wiretapping embassies and ambassadors in the United States. That's a separate, and that I agree with you that that is most likely the authority under which Michael Flynn's communications were intercepted.
But to be clear, that's not Section 702. Section 702 is only for non-U.S. persons overseas. So to target any non-American in the United States, whether an embassy or the cell phone used by a foreign agent, for example, you have to use one of the provisions of Title I of FISA.
So I heard you say that the relevant court, which I assume is the FISA court you're talking about, determined this was valid under the Fourth Amendment. As far as I know, this hasn't come before the Supreme Court yet, which could decide if it came that it was invalid. What do you think are the actual Fourth Amendment arguments here? Do you think that this is valid, and why or why not under the Fourth Amendment?
And who are you addressing that question to?
Both of you, everyone.
I mean, so I'll just very quickly say there's a case called Verdugo Urquidez, which says the actions of the United States directed against aliens overseas are not subject to the Fourth Amendment. But, Kate, I'll leave it to you to explain why, in your view, this is a Fourth Amendment concern.
Well, it raises Fourth Amendment concerns, I believe, because it's a search being conducted by the government inside the United States. And when it's this, quote, query, the backdoor query, it's a search targeted at an individual inside the United States, including an American citizen. There is no exception to the Fourth Amendment in that situation. And the information that's contained within the FBI's database, which is contents information, which is protected by the Fourth Amendment, and it's contents information that was seized in the United States without a warrant that covered that content because it was seized under 702.
Just to flesh out a little bit how I think the government would argue this, I mean, there's an important fact here, which is that these queries, these database queries that we're talking about, are of information, of communications that the government has already lawfully collected through other authorities and that are sitting in its own files. I don't think there's this is not to say that the Supreme Court could not reasonably hold that it's a Fourth Amendment search to query those files. But as far as I know, to date, there's not a case holding that it's a Fourth Amendment, an independent Fourth Amendment search for the government to check its own files for something. There are cases looking at whether the government can, say, look at every file on a laptop that it picks up in a physical search covered by another warrant, but that seems materially different. And here, these specific messages have already been collected and are already sitting on government databases through what the courts have held as a lawful search under Section 702.
Let's go to our next question.
Hey, Adam. I'm a former Intel officer, so I'm disposed to sort of side with you on this, but I wanted to push back a little bit on the applicability of the Fourth Amendment because it seems like these sort of vacuum cleaner operations of all information coming into the country from overseas by the NSA look a lot like the general warrants that the Founding Fathers were really pressing against when they brought the Fourth Amendment in to protect us from that sort of abuse. Can you address that a little more?
Sure. So I think it just helps to clarify the facts a little bit about what the program is actually doing. Under Section 702, NSA cannot simply bulk collect everything that comes into the United States over the internet, over the fiber optic cables entering the country. NSA can only collect under sort of the current, how the program currently operates, messages to or from a selector, that is an email address, a phone number, a social media handle, for example, that has been validly tasked under the program. And there are targeting procedures in place that limit what the that tell the government how to do this targeting. And so those procedures ensure that what we're talking about is a selector used by a non-US person overseas who is likely to communicate one type of foreign intelligence information that the government has been authorized to collect under the program by the FISA court. So in short, this is not bulk vacuum cleaner collection, which if conducted on American soil would certainly raise those type of concerns. This is targeted collection of specific selectors used by specific identified non-US persons who are physically located overseas. Sometimes there's a bit of bleed over in the public perception of the telephone call records program that Edward Snowden disclosed back in 2013. That was the program where the government had been authorized by the courts and Congress had been briefed on this to collect all of the telephone call records for all calls placed on major U.S. carriers. Verizon was one of the ones about whom the original sort of documents were leaked. And that program was bulk collection. It was not targeted. It did pull in information of all U.S. citizens who were using those phone carriers. And the Second Circuit Court of Appeals later said that that program was overbroad under the statute, much not even to speak of the Fourth Amendment. So I think it's important to distinguish between that type of bulk collection and Section 702, which is targeted. Now, that's not to say that information of people who aren't the targets doesn't get pulled in. Certainly it does. Sometimes that's good intelligence. Sometimes it's just overbroad. Any information that is collected in 702 is pulled in based on communications to or from a targeted person.
So just to add, I'm not going to argue about bulk versus targeted, but just to say that it's massive collection. The targeting procedures limited only to foreign intelligence matters. There's 100,000 identified targets, but those include organizations. And so for each target, there's presumably multiple selectors being used. And the best estimates are that literally probably hundreds of millions of communications are seized under 702 each year.
I agree with all of that. I think all of it is fair. This is probably a very large amount of information, and that's why it's important to have really good oversight by Congress and internally within the executive branch and, of course, by the courts.
Let's go to our final question.
Yeah, this is Mike Doherty in Atlanta. I have a question about just accountability. This big picture on this controversy, to me, boils down to a matter of trust, especially from the American people when they empower the government to have so much information. So what accountability have we seen when people violate this? So far, I would argue none. And So that could be the disappointment in the Trump administration not trying to tighten that up or enforce more. Do you see any movement in actual real-world accountability instead of huffing and puffing and nothing happening?
So I want to just add something to your question rather than answer it immediately, which is, you know, when people talk about accountability, they're talking about two different things, right? One is have the rules that are in place been violated? And that's what the accountability and oversight mechanisms are about. But then you have to ask, are the rules which are in place adequate? Because if they're not adequate, you can have what we would all consider to be abuses, which don't violate the rules, and therefore they're not found, and they're not, no one's held, quote, accountable for it. And so that distinction, I think, is lost in the discussion frequently.
Can I? I'm happy to address the question as well. I agree with you. Obviously, when there are when people overstep the line, there need to be consequences, whatever the line is. And I think we have seen accountability in this context. So, for example, the FISA court recently, this is the secret court that reauthorizes the program once a year with real Article III life tenure district court judges, recently forced NSA to stop collecting, to stop doing a significant type of collection that it had been doing. I won't get deep into the weeds on this. If you're interested, you can go to IC on the Record, which is the intelligence community's declassification site, and you can read the declassified opinion from April 2017, which will tell you all about this. The NSA was breaching the rules governing the program. It was all inadvertent, but it was nonetheless a significant compliance violation. The NSA eventually self-reported it to the government and self-reported it to the court, and the court effectively forced them to stop conducting this significant type of collection under the program. So that is an example of accountability in action. That's why you need to have the judiciary involved and Congress involved so that you get that accountability coming from the other branches of government. Now, in terms of 702, various reports have said and have found, looking into this on a classified level, that there have been no intentional abuses of the program. That's important. I mean, we've seen the Michael Flynn leaks with intelligence information coming from other types of collection, but at least in terms of 702 specifically, there haven't been any intentional abuses that anyone who's looked into this has found. Now, in terms of the leaks that I mentioned and some of the other controversies, it is up to the administration to decide whether there will be accountability, and it's in the administration's power and the Justice Department's power to investigate these leaks and to create consequences for them. One would think, based on the statements that the president and other officials have made, that there is interest, that they object to these leaks, clearly, and that there's interest in doing that. And so I hope they'll follow through on that and make clear that you can't leak information from foreign intelligence intercepts to damage another American.
Looks like we've already gone over our time, so I'll give our panelists a moment to make some final remarks, and then we can just close out the teleforum. Would either of you like to make some?
I would just say thank you, and to urge all listeners to stay involved. I think too often these authorities are extended without any real public involvement in what they really mean, and that this is very important, and this podcast is helpful, and people should inform themselves and stay involved.
I agree with that. I think we want to be safe, but we also want to be free, and we need to be free, and that means asking questions and holding the government accountable. So I think people on this call and elsewhere are right to do that.
A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website, at fedsoc.org/multimedia.